Welcome to the Appen Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. This is App, working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm not Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
Now, some of the astute of you might have noticed that I'm not Andy. Andy's wife isn't very well. So my name's John. I'm John the Nice Guy. Some might know me as on Twitter. And I'm not filling in for him this week. I'm here to correct some of the ills that that the other hosts of this podcast have cast upon you in the past. But however, as I am filling in for Andy in this occasion, I am obliged to cover off that this is number 55. 55 is obviously the 10th Fibonacci number. It was the highest speed allowed on highways in the US between 1974 and 1986, and it is a motorway which connects the M6 to Blackpool, which is obviously everyone's favourite holiday destination.
The Las Vegas of the North.
Well, indeed. It's 37 in hex, 110111 in binary, and 67 in octal. Do you know what, Andy? Come back, all is forgiven. I really can't do this again. It is, of course, the latest episode of the Admin podcast.
Yeah. So we have got John on this week. We did try and record an episode before, didn't we? A long time ago. I think it's like after last Odd Camp, wasn't it?
And might even have been a bit further before than that, to be honest.
Yeah. And it went all a bit pear-shaped. So John emailed us nicely in after a nice long email after our last episode, saying what we'd got wrong on that. So he's come on to correct us this week. So we'll just go through a couple of things before we get into it. So so what have you been up to then, Jerry, before we get on?
Well, I've been up to not going to work during the day anymore because I got made redundant about 3 weeks ago. So it's basically meant a lot less time in front of the computer. However, the computer that I am in front of now is a Linux laptop for the first time in about 2 years. So that's been quite interesting. I put Ubuntu 17.04 on it. I need to use it for my sort of smaller clients, so I couldn't do too much mucking around with it.
But this is a new laptop. This is a new laptop you got, isn't it? You got
an Asus ZenBook, which is about 2/3 of the price of a sort of decent MacBook Pro. Core i7, only 8 GB memory, 0.5 TB SSD for just under $1,000, which is just what I needed, really. So. Yeah, and then I've just been getting back into Linux on the desktop, which I haven't done for quite a while now, a good couple of years. Maybe I'll cover some of that in as the podcast goes on.
Yeah, actually, I can't think what I've been doing. It's been really busy doing work stuff, so not a lot to report on that, really. So what have you been up to, John?
That's a good question. So about 6 months ago, I changed jobs. Previously, I was working in the Security Operations Center for a major solutions integrator. I was doing a load of their back-end stuff. So I was making sure boxes were on backups and I was making sure they were on two-factor authentication and stuff like that. But I have a firewall background. So, you know, I've got quite a lot of knowledge about networks and sort of how things hang together from that side of views. And about 6 months ago, as I said, I changed jobs, and I'm now working in producing offerings, which basically has meant for me that I'm now learning a lot about OpenStack, not necessarily about the plumbings and the depths of the internals of it, but so I'm doing a lot with making boxes boot in OpenStack using Ansible and Python modules and the Python command line stuff. And
do you have a concept? I know AWS, I haven't looked at OpenStack yet, but you have user data in AWS, so that's basically sort of free form scripts that you can write which run the first time the machine boots.
Yeah, in fact, sort of the last sort of 7 or 8 blog posts, well, maybe not 7 or 8, but the last sort of 5 or 6 blog posts I've put together on my personal blog have been about kind of composing unwieldy cloud init files and stuff like that for the user data. So that's quite cool. Mostly about where I've gone wrong with stuff and sort of learning my way through it. But yeah, so it's a lot of playing with OpenStack and Ansible, which is part of the reason why I love listening to you guys and screaming at it, saying, "No, you're doing it all wrong." How about yourself? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, I forgot that's what I've been doing. It's I've been getting myself in Azure. We've been doing quite a lot with Azure and the whole JSON scripting. Well, it's not scripting, is it really? It's just, I don't know what you, is it templates, I'm guessing you call it, JSON?
Yeah. Is that to define infrastructure?
Yes. Sort of
thing? Okay. Have you looked at Terraform for Azure?
No.
You should, probably. Well, if it's anything, I haven't used it with Azure, but if it's anything like is for AWS, then it will make life a lot easier. It'll mean you won't have to muck around with JSON too much.
Yeah, it's quite good. Have you heard of Unidemy? Is it like a thing which like you can get online courses really cheaply?
Udemy, all? Yes.
Udemy.
One of the last things that I bought on there was about 12 different courses about, you know, various different cloud platforms, including AWS and Azure. So the interesting thing about Udemy is you can usually find a discount to bring it down to 10 quid per course. That's quite nice.
Yeah, cause that's what I found it, and someone said, "Oh, go ahead," and I bought three Azure courses for 30 quid. So
yeah, there's no
nice. So they're just online sort of CBT type stuff. Cool.
And you can watch them on your mobile, and I think they're like unlimited. Once you purchase them, you can watch them as many times as you want, kind of thing.
So. Yeah, totally. It's really good.
Yeah, I've watched the first couple of ones. The guy seems okay. So, yeah. So, what do you want to speak to John about then? Put us correctly from what we did, what we were saying wrong in the.
Well, okay. So there's a few. It's mostly semantics, to be fair. So in number 53, which obviously is not the most recent one, but in 53 you were talking about the OSI model and kind of how sort of the network hangs together based on that. And one of the main things that bugs me a bit about that is that actually the IP network that we use and rely on these days actually isn't an OSI model network. There's actually TCP has got its own model. It's the TCP IP. Sorry, it's actually called the IP model. Effectively, and you called most of these, to be fair, but all of your physical stuff to get your network connection into your computer is layer one. So that includes Wi-Fi, that includes wired networks. If you've got token ring or, you know, any of that fun stuff, it's all, you know, if you're following the OSI model, that's all classed as layer one. The TCP/IP model is a bit different. But people that have been in networking for any length of time try refer to stuff as being layer one, layer two, layer three. And effectively, until you get to layer three, it's kind of all the same. Layer two is sort of your ARP lookups and your MAC addresses and things like that. And basically anything that's on the same subnet is layer two. And then layer three is your routing stuff. It's the bit that gets you from your machine to something outside your network. That's layer three. And technically, IP addresses fall into layer three rather than layer two, even though it's the same subnet. As I said, it's all semantics. The main interesting bit, though, is that between OSI then refers to layers 4, 5, 6, and 7, and basically lots of different bits about IP fit into those 4, 5, 6, and 7 layers. So basically, most people look at layers 1, 2, 3, 7. And everything else is kind of just a bit of a blur. I think, Al, you were talking about subnetting and kind of replacing like a supernet of what is effectively 3 or 4 slash 24s
yeah.
into lots of little slash 24s. And actually, I the email I sent to you kind of says about, oh, you should really use VLANs to subnet it and as you're subnetting rather than doing, you know, just breaking down the slash 22, I think it was, into 4 slash 24s. And then I realized that, no, if you do that, then you've got to put another device into your network and it all gets a bit complicated. And then I said, well, what you could use is a layer 2 firewall. Again, it's not really layer 2 because it's TCP/IP, not OSI. But anyway, a layer 2 firewall basically is treated like a what they call a bump in the wire. So you can inspect the traffic that is talking MAC addresses rather than IP. But then what you've basically got to think about is who's going to support that at 2 o'clock in the morning when it all goes wrong.
Yeah.
And at that point, your different subnet stuff is interesting. So I've waffled on quite a bit there. But the main thing really that always gets my goat is when people refer to stuff as class A, class B, class C and class D. Because those type of addresses haven't existed for 20 years. It's all called CIDR or CIDR or stuff. CIDR, that's the one, yeah. Which is the slash notation that you'll see. So, for example, there are 3 private networks that don't get routed on the internet, which are 192.168/16, which covers everything from 192.168.0.0 through to 192.168.255.255. And they can be split down into lots of different subnets. There's 172.16/12, which gives you 172.16.0.0 to 172.31.255.255. And 10/8, which is 10.0.0.0 to 10.255.255.255. So those are 3 different classes, what used to be called classes of networks, that are now basically just CIDR or CIDR ranges. And in fact, you can actually separate subnet down a network from anything from a /0 down to /32, which is a single IP address. And it's interesting how you figure those out, because basically all you do is each time is you halve the network space. So a /0 gives you every IP address possible on the internet, including all the multicast, the non-routable stuff. It's all in there, one giant ball of stuff. /1 gives you 0.0000 to 127.255.255.255, and then 128.0.0.0 to 255.255.255. Anyway, so, and yeah, as I said, the normal one that most people see is a /24. Which is 255.255.255.0. I use all sorts of weird and wacky stuff at work, just because, you know, we get certain ranges of stuff we can use. So yes, that's all the things you've got wrong. Right, okay, should we wrap up the podcast there?
Yeah. Are we
done? 15 minutes? Job's a good one. No, okay. So any questions on that lot?
No, it all makes sense. It's so we weren't planning to go into it that detail that night, and it just got down a rabbit hole and just rambled on, I think. So,
I think that when I did say about the /24 and the 24 zeros, or 24 ones, is it? That just sort of came to me in the moment. It wasn't like something that I'd been hammered into me for the last 10 years. So it was a bit of a eureka.
So off the back of that, actually, I've shared with you guys a PDF of an Excel spreadsheet that I wrote at work that gives you all the different subnets and kind of how they split down, and then like a lookup chart that I use to figure out what stuff's in subnet and what stuff isn't. And it's 2 printed pages plus a covering page that you can or don't have to print.
And laminate?
Well, if mine doesn't tend to last that long, because it folds down quite neatly into like a tiny little credit card size thing. It tends to go in the back pocket, but then it tends to get ripped pretty quickly. And what it's got in it has got the usable subnet, usable host and subnet, and the including broadcast and network addresses. The start of an example subnet range, you know, from 0000 to what you would get in that range. It's also got the net mask, which is what Windows machines use typically, and Linux machines will sometimes use. But it's also got the Cisco mask as well, which is kind of the reverse. Because Cisco boxes will tend to, if you refer to a /24 as being 255.255.255.0, the Unix boxes actually work in reverse. So it would be 0.0000255. Is that on there? No, I might have taken that out now because I found it useless.
Is that like with the ACLs, don't they? And the access control list, they used to do that where you do the... That really confused me when you did it. They did it the opposite way around.
Yeah. But the other... the way that all this, the slash bits is worked out is actually... it's the binary... It's the number of binary ones in the four sub... The four octets. So it's... so the slash one has literally got one... number one at the beginning and 00000 at the rest of it, so it'll match the first binary number. Again, it's kind of odd, but yeah, you can do some weird things with subnetting.
This is all going to get a lot more complicated with IPv6, right?
Well, actually, no, it doesn't, because what they've done with IPv6. Is if you
apart from made the IP addresses look really confusing,
they have and they haven't. There are more IP addresses in IPv6 than there are grains of sand.
Yeah.
So they had to have some kind of crazy numbering scheme. But actually, if you follow the way that the CIDR masks work, with it just being 11111100000000, etc. What you can actually do is extend out the table that I produced down to, I can't remember if it goes as far as, as far as I know, there aren't an awful lot of places that have deployed IPv6. Mobile networks are the big one, really, and that doesn't tend to be in this country. It tends to be in the States, as far as I can tell. And the Department of Defense in the States was the largest user of IPv6 for the longest time, apparently. So I can't remember if it goes as far as 128 or if it goes as far as 256 as you're subnetting. But actually, if you just follow that table down of the 11111000 to the sort of 256 bits length, then actually it just works, because you say, well, you get from that address to that address, or from that address to that address. It just doesn't make any difference. I'm pointing at stuff, and only the guys that are watching the video that is recording this is going to see. Anyway, but yeah, so I mean, it does kind of make sense. And realistically, nobody should have been referring to 255.255.255.0 for such a long time, because IPv6, the CIDR masks just make life a lot easier. And it's really it feels really odd to me now when I refer to a network as being 255.255.255.0 instead of /24.
It's much easier to say.
It is indeed.
I was going to ask something while we're on the subject of protocols and things. Have you heard of RINA? RINA? The Recursive Internetwork Architecture?
No, that's not something I've come across.
I've been told about it. I think it's like an experimental at the moment, but it's not a global address space. It's basically a network of, I think, I'm not exactly sure how it works, but it's pretty worth looking at for someone like yourself.
So what was it, RINA? Recursive?
Yeah, Internetwork Architecture. I don't know enough about the technical details to actually say much about it, other than I know it's out there. So, and it gets around this whole global address space thing. It means you don't have to, you don't have every IP address on the internet. You can access different networks using this protocol, I suppose it's like it's more of a, what's the word, conglomeration of networks. Mm. I don't know anyway.
Interesting. I'll have to have a read of that one. That does look quite interesting. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. When we know more, when John's read up on that, we'll have him back on the show. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see.
Well, actually, no. What we need to do is make some mistakes about it.
That works.
When we talk about it. Yeah.
So yeah, IP6. Not really using it much in the UK yet, are we? Kind of thing.
No. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know about ISPs use it or anything. So, I mean, one of the colleagues at work, the networking guy, his ISP just finally given it to him. He was using the Hurricane tunnels or something you can get IPv6?
Yeah, there were two tunnelling companies that were providing IPv6. One was Hurricane Electric, which is still around, and the other was Six, SIXX. And they shut up shop, it was somewhere between 3 and 6 months ago, maybe even slightly longer, I think, offhand. But they actually shut down because they said that their existence was used as a reason not to deploy IPv6 on ISPs, because ISPs were saying, well, if you want to get IPv6, go with 6 instead. So that was a bit naughty. I tried both and couldn't get either of them to work with my home network. But then again, I do have a ridiculously complicated IPv6 environment. A ridiculous home network. I think I counted somewhere in the region of about 50 to 60 hosts on my home network. So that's what.
Yeah, you posted a diagram, didn't you, on the Telegram channel?
Yes.
Was it? Yeah. I mean, a lot of them are just. I mean, a lot of people do have quite a few devices these days because of, iPads, mobile phones, Chromecasts, tellies, things like that that didn't used to be on the network.
You just mentioned something there, Jerry, about the Telegram group, which we haven't told anyone else about.
Yeah, if you go to www.admin.admin.podcast.co.uk/telegram, then you can join our Telegram channel.
Yeah, well, we have five people so far.
I'm not talking to Al or Andy here, but go there, join up to the Telegram group and say hello.
Yeah. I guess, because I don't know if other people know what it is. I mean, most of the other Linuxy podcasts have got them, haven't they? Is it encrypted
it's
or not?
It's basically an IR. Apparently Steve Gibson took that apart a bit.
Well, so they made a mistake in that they rolled their own cryptography, which is never a good thing. They then set up prove that our crypto is not very good with an unmeetable challenge, and generally speaking, the cryptography community, which is another one that I follow, not particularly on the maths side of things, but out of an interest side of things, the cryptography community basically tore it apart and said it's no good. The maths just don't add up. And actually, as much as I like Telegram for the various podcasts and kind of being able to talk to the communities, they have earned a black mark in my book this week, because this week Russian government said you can only operate in our borders if you let us in. And they said, okay, we'll let you in. So they're now, people that use Telegram are subject, in theory, to monitoring by foreign governments, which is a bit of a no-no to me. But then again, if they didn't do that, then Telegram would be verboten in Russia. So it's tricky.
But also, I mean, anyone that uses Slack, for instance, which is a lot of people everywhere, there's a good chance that all their stuff is able to be read by the US government, another foreign government.
Well, indeed. Yeah. And I mean, and what makes it worse is that, I say worse, what makes it different is that Slack also has, all of these messaging systems have got you need to have a credential to get into them. And Slack has been particularly hard hammered by the fact that people were putting the keys to be able to access the Slack bots into GitHub commits and stuff like that. So people were then losing control of their channels because their API keys were open. The messaging protocol that I've been following most closely and I'm most interested in is actually Matrix.org, which is a decentralized messaging network. Not that I want to disparage Telegram at all, because as I said, I do use Telegram a lot. But Matrix.org is... it's a little bit like IRC, and it feels a lot like IRC, which is for those youngsters out there, and not the sorts of people like me who got horrifically addicted to IRC in university. IRC is a predominantly text only chat system, which has got channels and personal chats. But the interesting thing for me about Matrix is that they're using the Axolotl messaging encryption system that the guys from Whisper Systems created. But they've wrapped it into... so that's an end-to-end encryption. So basically, if you and I were typing messages on there, we would basically have a an encrypted on our devices and past encrypted messages. But to scale it up, so that's what Signal and also WhatsApp use for their one-to-one chats. Yeah. And you can extend that out to a group chat, which again, I should add, I'm also using Signal as well as WhatsApp because different people, different contexts, etc. So Matrix has taken the Axolotl protocol and morphed it into what they call Ohm. I don't know why they call it Ohm. It's in the wiki, I'm sure. And then Mega Ohm, which is how they can do multi-device, multi-person chat, basically all using this pre-keyed conversation system. It's really very clever. And there are bridges from Matrix into lots of different other chat networks, which again comes back to this decentralized nature of it. And I can run a Matrix server, although I don't. I can run a Matrix server at home, and it will be accessible to all the other Matrix networks. I am very conscious of the fact that I'm doing a lot of the talking in this podcast, and I'm really sorry, guys.
It's good. It's good.
That sounds pretty cool. Just to follow up on that, Telegram is decentralized,
nope,
isn't it?
Not at all. It's all centralized.
Oh, it's not? Oh, okay, right. Oh, right, okay. I did not know that. And obviously Slack is also centralized.
Yep, Slack, Telegram, Signal, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, IRC, they're all centralized.
As opposed to peer-to-peer.
Technically at the moment, Matrix is, I think, still in beta, probably. And they are about to swap out their... Well, I say about. They are developing a core, a replacement for their core server. So, interestingly, one of the other things that I do is I'm helping to co-organise OddCamp this year, which you guys have mentioned for me in the past. And we are hoping, we're still waiting for absolute confirmation, but we are hoping that the lead developer of Matrix will actually be at OddCamp and giving a talk on how Matrix works and stuff like that. So... if anyone has any questions about Matrix, then they should perhaps consider coming to a tiny little event that I'm organising later in the year, 19th and 20th of August, no less.
Yay!
And whereabouts is that?
So that would be in Canterbury at the Christchurch Christchurch College at Canterbury University, and it's going to be a fantastic event. There are still tickets available, so.
Yeah.
So it's a free culture unconference.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
It's a celebration of all things free culture and free software and all those sorts of fun things. It's not specifically a free software conference. It's not specifically an open source or a Creative Commons unconference. It is an unconference about anything collaborative, but particularly focusing on free software and free culture and open source software.
So. And I'll be there.
Huzzah!
Yeah, I'll be there.
I managed to get my on-course swap so that I can go, because I was meant to be going to FozTalk Live, but that all went a bit pear-shaped, so, but I managed to get wife points so that I could not go in that, so I can get on camp and swapped on call, so that I'll be there. So I think it's, yeah, you can, yeah, I don't know what I'm going to be doing about staying in the hotel or whatever, if I'm going to go camping or not. So
I have seen people mentioning that they want to try and organise camping at Odd Camp again, because that has happened before.
Odd camping. Al, you did it in October though?
Or yeah, was it in Liverpool? I did an Airbnb in Liverpool, but the one before that was Oxford. I camped there, which is really good.
I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was late.
Was it half term? Well, it's normally like half term time, isn't it? Kind of things. But the problem with going and camping is you have to get from the campsite, if you're staying out drinking, and getting from the campsite back, or getting from the sand to the campsite. So have a quick look at the campsite tonight. There's not one right in the centre.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
I have noticed in the little video display that we might have somebody else here that is supplanting my role of not being Andy.
The real Andy.
The real Andy.
Hello.
And that was my order now. Oh, yes, it is. I'm coming through. Yeah, better late than never. So.
I tried to fill in best for you as I could.
I've just been peeking in from a distance for the past 5 minutes. So, if you feel like someone's been looking at the back of your neck or something, it was me.
So. Explained a lot. Thank you.
So, Andy, what have you been up to?
What have I been up to? Nothing. Right, next. No. I suppose there's two things I thought I'd bring, because we've been talking a little bit about this on our on the Telegram feed that we have. And actually, I've got some questions about it, which one of you should know the answer to, at least, I'm hoping. Who was it? I think you've all probably answered about this. I was talking about on this network where only some websites weren't being accessed. Generally secure sites, you know, like banking websites. They could get to most websites, but they couldn't get to the likes of NatWest and Barclays and, anything like that. And it basically came down to, MTU settings on the router.
Oh.
It's always MTU. It's always MTU.
Yeah. No. It was quite high, because it's just a standard, I don't know what it is on a BT Hub 5, it's 1492 or something like that, is it? Something like that, standard. So we basically lowered it. It has gone quite low now. I know that you shouldn't take it less than 1400. I don't know if that's right or not, but that's what I've heard. That's probably too low. So I can't remember how low I've took it now, but I've took it down and it's a lot more stable and working now. But my question to any of you is, why? Why would that make a difference? And why would it all of a sudden make a difference? You know, when it's worked in this place for years on end, why does it suddenly change? Does it have anything to do with local network as well, or is it purely
not
external?
Really. So there's an interesting thing about MTU, which is that it's the MTU stands for the maximum transmission unit, which is basically the length of the packet. And even if you set yours to like 3 million, you know, something ludicrously high, the next hop out is going to say that's too big and fragment the packets down. Okay. That actually suggests to me that that there's issues on the line between the router that you're working on and the gateway for that box. So whatever box that is, that the gateway is, that's probably where your network issue is. So it could be that the DSL's faulty. There could be an issue with the line. It could be anything like that.
So when you say the box, you mean like the telephone exchange or
yeah, so
the fiber, the little green hub down the road.
Yeah. Or even further up the line than that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because essentially, yes, the standard for MTU is about 1500, round about there. I have seen it down as low as 800 before, and it's not been disastrous. But what happens is when you start cranking it down that low, there's two things. The first is that your boxes on your network all assume an MTU of about 1500. So they'll send a packet, and if it hits a gateway that the MTU is not at that point, it sends a message back saying you've got to fragment this packet. So then you've got retries in your network, and if it keeps retrying too much, my forte is not sort of backbone networks, but I have seen sort of, you know, people saying, you know, what you get is if you get too many of these retries, the packet times out, the session times out, and something, you know, your stateful inspection firewall on the router or something at the other end of that link will say, no, your session's taken too long to establish, killing it off. So that might be why it's dying out. And on top of that as well, TLS encrypted packets, which is HTTPS, are bigger, and because you've got the overhead in the packet of the encryption and the hashing plus the plain text. Now, admittedly, they do then compress it, so you do get a level of compression in it. But I'd say that having an MTU of if you need to ramp it down as low as 800, it will still work, but you will see that latency issue start creeping in there.
Okay, well, that explains why it was just on secure, because they also use it's basically an estate agents.
Mm-hmm.
And they use this piece of software which again is secure, and they use it where they put, now if you went to Rightmove website, right, they basically take the information, upload the photographs, the text, the floor plans of the houses that they're selling and stuff like that, and this software uploads it to the likes of Rightmove and puts them on the market, as it were. That's the other piece of software that they were having trouble with as well.
Mm.
But again, that was something else that required HTTPS login to begin with, you see. So that's where it was all secure sites. Even the likes of, I know they bank with NatWest, for example. Even the likes of NatWest, not just a normal homepage.
Mm.
Of course, I'm pretty sure that's still HTTPS, isn't it, on the normal homepage?
Yeah.
Because that was taking ages to come up, and sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't, and more often it wouldn't.
Mm.
But if you went to the likes of, you know, a simple website or bbc.co.uk or something like that, you know, it'd be instant. So
most websites are now HTTPS anyway, aren't they? So it'd be harder to find one that wasn't.
That could go to edge to something else or segue. But before we go on that, MTU, because we always had a problem at work where we had to get printing working right, you had to change the MTU size. Well, printing over the network, if you like, in a wide area network, you'd have to always make sure that the MTU was set right, because if not, it would fail to print, kind of thing. So,
but that might well be because the it might be sending the packets over UDP, and UDP doesn't have that ability to kind of ratchet back the speed as much.
Yeah.
So
is that like the same thing as windowing as well, with like the kind of deciding on how much data to send in the packet kind of thing?
Yes. Right. So MTU is the largest size that packet will be, that window will be. And what typically happens is your packet starts out very small, cranks up, and then at the point at which it starts getting those retransmission errors, it then starts backing back down again until it meets this kind of median point where it's working. So that's that's what the windowing's about. Again, it's not something that I've particularly looked into because it's not something I've had to, but obviously, you know, as I mentioned before, my background's in firewalls, and what I was tending to be called in on firewall calls was, you know, you'd get called in because you can look at the whole network, so you tend to get involved in, because the firewall's not a core part of the network, but most traffic in the network passes through the firewall. And it's difficult to do inspection on switches and routers without having kind of pre-configured them to have a tap port or a span port or something. You know, you'd end up being involved in these calls just because the traffic was crossing your box and you're being asked to check, you know, whether traffic's actually going through where your milestone is in the network. So that's where the sort of the knowledge about the window size. So feel free, anyone who listening to this and screaming at their radio or their podcast player saying, you know, John's got it all wrong because he's useless, I'm more than happy to admit I'm wrong on this stuff. So yeah, you know,
so going back to the segue thing is that obviously with secure connection for websites, TLS, we basically using Let's Encrypt, got so we can get a certificate now on the Abnabin podcast. I haven't done anything where it like flips you over at the moment, so like if you go to HTTP and then automatically fit you, because I've heard problems where if the RSS feed, some can't support HTTPS yet, so I haven't done that. But
it doesn't tend to be that the podcast feeds can't support HTTPS. It tends to be that podcast clients will see the fact that you've gone to HTTPS, and they usually tend to hash the a lot of podcast clients will hash the URL for the pod feed, mm-hmm. the show feed, and will see that you've put an HTTPS one in, and they will then re-download the whole thing.
Yeah.
So you're almost better off having it 304. I think it's 304. No, 302. Temporarily redirected to the HTTPS. For the file,
yeah,
but then all of your new shows going forwards should be HTTPS listed as HTTPS URLs. Either that or pre-warn people you're about to re-download one of our shows for the past 25 shows.
I'm sure people will welcome the chance to listen to the last 25 shows again, the last 55 shows.
So the certificate, so for the Let's Encrypt, is only for 3 months. So correct. You have to rerun the command with the cert bot to regenerate the certificate. And I've got the command, which I manually run at the moment, every 3 months.
I do the same, actually. I haven't got round to...
So I basically put it into a shell script and change it so it's an executable. And if you run that script, it works. But obviously, I want to put it into a cron job in the cron tab, and I wanted to know. I was asking, where should you put that file? Because obviously, where's the best place to put it? Because obviously, normally what I do is I don't use the root account at all on my box, and I just normally just log on as myself as SU, and then just wondered where the best place to put that file is in Linux.
Interesting. So I use Let's Encrypt on all sorts of bits and pieces, and I've got so what I found was that actually Let's Encrypt sticks a cron job in automatically into etc cron.d certbot.
3 monthly.
No, so it actually runs every, so this 12 hours I think it is. And actually, I've got the command here. It goes test minus x user local sbin certbot or dash auto perl minus e sleep int rand 3600, and then user local sbin certbot dash auto slash minus q new. So I then get an email every 2.5 months saying we just renewed your certificate for you. So it actually does it all automatically for you. And you'll probably find that if you have a look in that etc cron.d path, you'll actually find the certbot in there.
So is it doing it through Apache in this case, because the way Let's Encrypt works is it talks to port 80. You run certport and it's talking to validate the certificate. It's talking to port 80 on your server.
The first time.
Or, yeah.
First time. So, yeah. Yes. What Let's Encrypt does is it creates in your web root a file called a directory called well known, and it's usually dot well known, and that's because Unix files that start with a dot are hidden directories.
Hidden, yeah.
So in dot well known there will be a file that tells certbot this domain's validated, these are the URLs it's been validated for, etc. So as long as whichever web server it is you're using has got that dot well-known directory in it, you can use it.
Mm.
Now, when I first started using Let's Encrypt, it only supported Apache, but there's now plugins for Nginx as well that I know of, because I'm using Nginx on everything. So it will reload the Nginx config and stuff for you. And it just automatically does it all itself. It's like magic. It's brilliant.
I think because I had Nginx and it wasn't working with Nginx, or it was experimental. It's like Hibby Dragon sort of thing. Which I probably should have done it, because my web server is really non-essential and it's not a sort of 5 nines uptime job.
No, so in fact, actually, somewhat weirdly, before I started recording this, I actually shut my personal server down because it lives on my home network, and I was worried that if anybody tried to actually access my machine whilst I was on this podcast, all you'd hear is... So I figured it was safest to down all the interface on my server. So I use certbot on all sorts of things. Another little string to my bow is I actually one of the admins of lug.org.uk. So we're in the process of Let's Encrypting all the domains that use lug.org.uk. And that's fun because we've got about 60 domains, the subdomains of lug.org.uk on lug.org.uk. And you're only allowed 10 per week, I think it is, or 5 per week. So I'm kind of having to get my head around that pretty quickly. So that's fun. So I use it at home, and it's dead simple, because you literally just do certbot -d domain name, enter, and it goes, where's the file to stick this web root in? Oh, it's in that config file there. Brilliant. I'll just use that then. Fantastic.
Yeah, because on my free BSD box, it's got my command to renew it is certbot renew, then hyphen. It's got about pre-hook about stopping and starting. Nginx, so I'll have a look at that then. So, but where would you recommend putting the scripts? Because I was thinking, if you put it in your home directory, obviously, is it guess to put it in like, so you say like user bin or something, Andy or something, or Jerry even? Sorry.
Well, I would say use a local bin, but because that's generally in the path for every user, with cron anyway, you want to use a full path when you're calling something, because it can be funny.
You definitely can't rely on cron knowing your path.
Yeah. So, yeah, you can stick it anywhere, but use a local bin is a good place for a script that can be run by anyone on the system. Yeah.
So there's a
stick
few...
Stick it in the bin.
There's a...
If in doubt, stick it in the bin. I'd put it in the bin.
So there's a thing called the Linux... LSB, Linux Standard Base, which defines a standard file system hierarchy. User contains bin, sbin, and stuff. User local contains bin, sbin, and stuff. There's opt, which can contain
third-party software
stuff as well. And also you've got bin and sbin as well. So you've got lots of different places you can put stuff in your file system. What I tend to find is that if I'll follow conventions, so different OSs, different, even down to the distributions, will do things differently. So typically on an Ubuntu system, you don't tend to see a lot of stuff in user local bin. So I will tend to put my scripts in user local bin. I have seen systems that will symlink bin and sbin to use a local bin and sbin because the need to have all your different binaries in different places on your system went away in about the 70s and the other file system. Essentially, what it used to be was you'd have your binary files that you needed to boot a system up lived in bin, sorry, in sbin, and the stuff to do with loading user stuff, so system stuff was in sbin, your user stuff was in bin, so you'd bring enough of the file system up in sbin, which would live in root. You'd then use the files in sbin to boot, to mount your the rest of your file systems. So that's where your user local, your opt, your vars, your temps, and all those sorts of things, that would all come up at that point. So those, anything after that point would then live in user local bin or user bin or opt bin or wherever from there. So that's where that history comes from. Obviously, I think it was only two or three years ago that Fedora said, this is ridiculous, why are we doing this? And they trashed it all off. But the other side to that is anything that I run as a user, I tend to keep in bin in my home directory or local bin in my home directory. And it just depends on, again, OS conventions.
But then if you keep that in your home directory, you generally have to add that to your path manually. It's not used usually in the path by default.
It depends. So the reason that I've started using local bin is actually because Ubuntu does support local bin as well as bin in your user path. In the cron tab, the cron file, you can add a path instruction and tell it which paths to use. So you can, as a user, type the echo space dollar path, and it will just dump out the string that you then put into your cron tab. But essentially it depends on how much segregation you want between different parts of your file system. So I tend to, stuff that I've written for me goes in local bin, and stuff that I've imported for my user account from somewhere else goes into bin.
What about scripts you want to run as root, and only root can run?
So they would go in root bin or root local bin.
Oh, okay.
Depending on, again, whether it's something I've written for me or whether it's something I've imported to use. So there you go. So does that answer your question?
Yes. So, but I might have a look at if there's some more documentation that you say on the that command to see if there's another option. Why? But I don't know, put it in my ch root or in the sudo file. No, in the Chrome tab to see. Yeah, cool. So yeah. So what else? So Jerry, what distro did you say you were using on your new laptop?
Ubuntu 17.04. I kind of regretted it because it doesn't support ZFS on Linux properly, or root. The root partition can't be ZFS. Because kind of my plan was to, I've got a ZFS partition set, a ZFS ZFS partition on there, and what I want to do is be able to boot into different distributions that are installed on ZFS, so I can have them snapshotted and everything.
So you're not using ButterFS?
No, decided to go with ZFS because my stuff on my laptop is generally important to me, and I don't want to lose it. Although the kind of configuration I'll be using on a single disk is probably safe enough. But I just wanted to play around with ZFS because I haven't done it yet. But it turns out Ubuntu 17.04 doesn't support it. It doesn't support doing that anyway. So I am just still on ext4 on there.
And did you go for the Unity then? You don't.
Yeah, well, I know it's on its way out, but Unity comes by default with Ubuntu. This is the last version, I think. I've just been getting into that, really. First time I've really used it. I haven't really used Linux on the desktop that much before now. I've had a Mac for the last 2 years, so it's a brave new world. I mean, I found it, there's been times when I've just had to reboot the machine because the window manager's locked up for some reason. There was a thing with the terminal, just like all the terminals closing when you do something. I think it was something in the preferences, which is not what you need when you've got like 15 terminals open working on stuff.
But I can't believe you're not running there. I mean, if it's a production machine, I always put LTS on it, so I don't.
Yeah, I probably should actually. We should go back and do that. I think my home directory is on a separate partition, so it's easy enough to do.
So you're saying, John, about that you run KDE quite a lot of most of the time then? So.
Yeah, so my machine, my laptop at home is dual booted Windows 10, basically for anything that doesn't run on Linux, and then Kubuntu 16.04, which is the LTS release. But I use the KDE backports, which I spotted somewhere random. Because I wrote a blog post because I wanted to use full disk encryption on Windows 10 and on Ubuntu. Started following down various different paths and end up tried to use KDE Neon, which while it does have an LTS release. And it is usable as a user desktop. What I found was that whilst it's based on Ubuntu and you can use Ubuntu packages, it wasn't really very stable for me. So I went back to using KDE on Kubuntu. And by using the backports, I've found that I'm basically getting what is effectively the KDE Neon almost experience without sacrificing the other applications that are part of Ubuntu as part of that. But then again, you know, I was using so I went to KDE because obviously Canonical announced they were demising the Unity interface. Now obviously staying with the 16.04, you're going to have 5 years of support on that. So if you like Unity, you've got 5 years of Unity. And I generally liked Unity, but what I want to do is actually follow what is being developed, realistically. So I tried GNOME, which is where Canonical are going next, with Ubuntu, and I tried it, and generally I didn't like it. It's not to say there's anything wrong with it, but there were too many niggles that I couldn't work around. And I actually found a tutorial for making KDE look like Unity and operate like Unity. And I thought, brilliant, that's exactly what I want. So I followed those instructions, and that was fantastic. And then I used it in a VM on my work machine. And I just couldn't make it work the way I wanted it to. And it's partially because, it didn't work the way I wanted it to. And so I went back to stock KDE and actually found that I quite prefer stock KDE to trying to make it look like another desktop environment. And again, that's not to say that any other desktop environment is not good. But yes, I'm generally personally favouring KDE at the moment. So
yeah, I tried the KDE Neon. And that worked on my test laptop. It booted onto, I didn't install it, and it worked fine. So, but I tried those at the Kubuntu, but I couldn't get my laptop to boot off the downloaded image. And I haven't had a look at the time, but when I looked at it, and I actually run the thing where you can check it, I was like, maybe it's a corrupt image. So I downloaded it again. And we need that thing where you can do, I can't think what it's called, the where you check the MD, yeah, to check someone. It differed from what the actual live one, what it reported on the website. So.
And therein lies the reason why we need HTTPS everywhere.
Yeah.
But no, yeah. If you've had a bad download, absolutely. To be fair, I'd say your best bet with any Linux distribution where they offered BitTorrent download is to get it over BitTorrent, because actually, one of the nice things about BitTorrent is that it hashes each block that it sends. So if you get a badly hashed block, it'll trash it and start again.
Yeah.
So you're always better off using a BitTorrent download for a Linux distribution or any large file where they offer it as an option to you.
And it's normally faster as well, I noticed as well, when you're downloading distros as well.
Well, I mean, I don't know whether anyone remembers sort of trying to FTP files down sort of in the really early days of early-ish days of the internet, when it was, yeah. But the interesting thing that I found with FTPing files down was that actually if you had like two or three client sessions all trying to download parts of the same file at the same time from the same URL, you'd actually get it faster because of the way that the blocking was working in the chunking that it was getting the lumps down. And essentially, BitTorrent does the same thing. Because you're getting files from lots of different peers at the same time, you're getting them, you're basically maxing out your bandwidth at your end rather than maxing out the bandwidth at the server's end. Plus, also, it means that the server's bandwidth hosting is lower, which is nice.
Cool. We've gone up to about an hour on the podcast, which we normally call it a night on a Sunday, getting quite late. Have you got anything else to say, Andy? Because you did say you had two things. Did you go over to both your things, what you wanted to go over with?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the other thing was, last week I was talking about that laptop.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask about that.
I was going to repair it, if you like. And I said we just reloaded, because Ubuntu was running pretty slow on it, really. So I put on what's the one? Next Ubuntu, is it?
It's Ubuntu, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, well, in essence, that runs a lot better than Ubuntu does. You know, just in a general clicking around. I don't really use it for much, really. It's just general internet browsing, you know, instead of using Windows, I suppose, but it's just general internet browsing. It seems to run a lot better. And I found out what when I had Ubuntu when it was coming up with that error message that caused the problem in the first place. So it was basically when I took the back off, there was a catch where, you know, you'd put the hard drive in, it'd slide in. And then, so it kind of slid in, and then when you put the cover on top of it, there was two prongs that kind of held it in place, you see, because there was no screw in it to hold the hard drive in. So it had basically, the prongs had broke or been pushed back, because this had happened before. Somebody gave me this laptop. So what had happened is, the reason I was getting these error messages in the first place is because the hard drive had kind of half come out of the SATA slot, because the prongs weren't holding it in anymore. So that was the cause of the error in the first place, because I think one of you said that, you know, it could be hard drive going faulty. Well, basically it was the hard drive sliding out of the of the SATA slot. So put that back in. So this Xubuntu is working a lot better. Yeah.
You basically, in the Telegram group again, so join us again, you were saying about that it was coming about, like, it was an F check, wasn't it, on the disk? So
yeah, I can't remember what the error message was now, but
Yeah. So, cool. Okay. Well, yeah. Remember, you can get us on the Attitude Telegram, which is www.adminadminpodcast.co.uk /Telegram, and that should redirect you to the link to get you onto the Telegram group. Have you got anything else to say? Yeah, Odd Camp. Anyway, yeah, John, thanks for coming on. How can people get in contact with you if they want to? Or
so I am at John the Nice Guy. That's JonTheNiceGuy. Pretty much on everything. So I'm on Twitter as that. I'm on Facebook as that. I'm on LinkedIn as that. So if you want to use contact me via social media. I also have a blog, JonJon.Sprig.GS. So feel free to follow my posts on there as well.
So until next time, guys. Speak to you all soon.
That's it. See you soon. Bye now.
Bye.